You are unique, active, determined, resilient. You are not your diagnosis, and you are not alone. This is Young Onset Parkinson's Network. We believe young onset Parkinson's disease does not define you. You define it. We are a safe place to learn, connect, and engage within a supportive community that actually gets it, because we've got it too. Welcome to Young Onset Parkinson's Network. Living well starts here.
Here is part two of Esther's interview. In part two, she delves into the topic of hospital emergency care for Parkinson's disease patients and much more. Listen in. Hope you enjoy.
I'm the most recently diagnosed of the group in 2018 at 52, and I'm starting to go through a lot of the things that other people are going through. What I want to understand is, how can we educate people who are newly diagnosed? And they know this is like my life's passion, to figure out, like, you went in knowing a lot of stuff because of your background. What about the rest of us who have absolutely no concept of what is happening to them and going to 500 different doctors? How do we tell people or give them advice so they don't have to go through that?
Yeah. And so that's what I just got super obsessed with immediately. So first of all, I want to say I'm not a person comfortable with recording myself. I do not like my appearance and I hate the sound of my own voice. So what I did in the beginning with all this was very difficult for me. But I read something, and I read a lot, and I listen to the podcast, and I just am like a sponge. And I remember somebody said somewhere that with Parkinson's, you need, with YOPD in particular, you need to do something outside your comfort zone every day. And that's what TikTok became for me, because I thought about it a lot. And then one day I was just like, everything is telling me don't do this. I'm going to go on the internet and like people are going to shred me. immediately. And my kids are going to say I'm cringe and it's going to be like a nightmare for everyone. But I did it and I forced myself to do it. But that was why I did it, because I felt alone and I was looking. I was looking for somebody that looked like me. And if I'm thinking that, one thing I know is I'm not special. Okay. I'm not having some unique thought in this planet that nobody's ever had before. If it's running through my brain, a bunch of other people are thinking the same thing. So I got so obsessed with like, why is that point of diagnosis so jacked up? Like, there's no way to tell us that you're going to be like, woohoo, I'm going to call all my friends now and tell them the good news. Like, it's always going to suck. But where's the information? And because part of what I do professionally is also what we call regulatory compliance, I know the laws and the rules of the game, right? And the laws and the rules say that when you diagnose a patient, you are supposed to give them education. And they do that. Do you know why? Because they get more money to do it. The way the billing is, that patient education piece gets them more money. Every little piece of an encounter with a physician has a code associated with it. And as they check through that EHR, when they're doing their little typey-type drop-down menu situation, it's dollars, right? And so they have to complete all of these things, all of these requirements to get paid. And that's what it has become, unfortunately, is just a very check. And I think patient education is the key to that. And so I immediately, because what I do in quality improvement, process improvement for my career is, we call it root cause analysis, right? So one of the tools in that is called the 5 whys. And all of this stuff is through the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. That's like the end all be all for quality people like me. So that's how my brain works, is like, why? Why was it so bad? Well, because they didn't really talk to me. Well, why didn't they talk to me? Well, because they're not good communicators, or they don't have time. Well, why aren't they good communicators? Well, probably because they do this 50 times a year. And so they've depersonalized it for themselves. Well, why? Because they haven't seen anybody that is connected to them, right? I didn't care until it was me. And it's the same for them. So how can we fix this? Well, I can go to them and I can say, like, look at me. I'm just like you. I'm your mother and your sister. I'm your friend. You're my neighbor. Would you want it to be like that for you or somebody you love, right? And do you have information to give us? It's super confusing out there with all the orgs and stuff. Who the hell is Davis Finney? Who the hell is Brian Grant? Like, I don't know. I'm like, which one do I go to? Who knows what? And because of TikTok, I got in contact with the Parkinson's Foundation. And I really liked their resources. And that's what I wanted. I was looking for something I could have in my hand to give to somebody like me at that point of diagnosis. And that's what they provided me. I have them in English and Spanish. They're just like little postcards that have the helpline, the website, who to call. And I have tons of other information from them too. And I told them, now I'm a member of their advisory board. And I had my first meeting actually Monday for the subcommittee that does mission and outreach. And they're like, what do you want to do? I'm like, I want every person that gets diagnosed with Parkinson's to have this in their hand when they leave, because sitting in your car empty handed, like if I didn't have kids and my husband there, I probably would have driven to a bar, gotten faced and like driven off a cliff or something, you know, and nobody would have known until I didn't show up for my 3-month follow-up, and then nobody would have cared anyway. So that's what I'm like super hyper focused on now, is like reaching out to these physicians, because it's not just neurologists, it's primary care, it's everybody. Like, we can do better. Can we get like a sticky note with www.michaeljfox written on it or something? Like, damn.
I'm going to say something to that because it makes me emotional, because when I got diagnosed, I was like, okay, you have Parkinson's. See you in 6 months. Here's your medicine.
Yeah.
There was no middle ground. There was not one other word mentioned to me. And it didn't change until I started boxing at my gym specifically for Parkinson's. And that's where I found out all the information. But that was a few months after. I was the same as you. I sat there. I sat on the couch for 4 months and was told that anxiety, depression, all that wasn't a part of Parkinson's. So we all have our channels, like you said, that we're going through. We need something that, and yes, it's a piece of paper or a card, but the problem is the doctors aren't doing that. What's the solution for when you walk out of there of understanding sort of what your journey may be like?
That's also why, as much of a freaking nightmare this is, and I never thought my life would have anything to do with any of this, and I'm still like on the daily, like, really, what am I doing here? I feel like I'm well positioned to speak to that. Okay. Nothing in healthcare ever changes, unfortunately, unless it's tied to money. That's just the reality of it. I mean, I could go and I will go to and do the free bagel tour of the doctor's offices. But it's whack-a-mole, because it's going to depend on, you know, who's in the office at that time and their mood and all that good stuff. So until the government gets serious about fixing these things, and this is not just for Parkinson's, it's going to be like that. I mean, I had a whole rant one time about, I talked to so many people now about their diagnosis, and I've heard so many horror stories about people finding out like through the patient portal. And I think about that, because if I would have gone and got that DAT scan, I would have found out through the patient portal too, right? Mm-hmm. And that's some bullshit. Like, that makes me really mad. That was not what patient portal was ever supposed to be, because I was there in the rooms when we were talking about these things and what it was supposed to be, to empower patients with their healthcare. That tool was a very quality improvement driven tool that we were all super excited about. But since I come from the hospital, I never saw it in action, right? Because you don't get your test results from the hospital through the patient portal. You get like appointment reminders and stuff. But in ambulatory since I've been working in ambulatory care, when I realized like cancer patients are getting like lab results through patient portal, that's cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. We always intended there to be stopgap measures that would force you to have those results given to you and explained to you by your whoever ordered them. And that the fact that that's not happening was like shocking to me. But again, we all pushed it out like that because the government forced us to push it out. They said, if you want to get paid, you have to push information via electronic portals, right? So then we all scrambled. We got the different portals. And now that's why you have all these different portals that don't talk to each other. Because we're really good at having these ideas and pushing them out, but then we're not good at like revisiting what's working and adapting, because it's very much like the government dumps a bunch of money on you and then you just implement. We did a thing. And then if it goes left, there's no like, because by then the administrations have changed and you know what I mean? The people that did it are doing consulting somewhere. Like it doesn't work like that. And that's why I keep saying until there is some kind of function in place by the government tied to reimbursement associated with the coding for Parkinson's disease that says you have to be provided with certain education, you have to get a referral to a physical therapist, you have to give them a referral to an occupational therapist, you have to see them for a follow-up within 3 months, you have to have, let's say, a DAT scan or a skin test, you have to, do you know what I mean? And unless you bundle that, we love bundles in healthcare, unless you bundle it all, you tie it to reimbursement, and then you have some kind of outside oversight, then it never stays, it never gets fixed, or it never stays fixed. And the American Academy of Neurology actually has quality indicators already around that. But why would anybody use that? Like, why would anybody do that? There's nothing in it for the doctors. It's only until it gets tied to what we call quality payment incentives that they'll start to do it. And we have those, they're called MIPS. And it's for physicians and offices in particular. And, but I could say the same on the hospital side for a lot of things that bad that happens to us in the hospital, but until they tie it to that. And actually Parkinson's Foundation has a really great podcast out from about 2 months ago, where they have a quality hero of mine on there talking about how they're pilot testing some checklists and stuff for the hospital side. But he said exactly what I just said. And it was crazy to hear it said, because I was like, yes, until it's tied to the quality measures and reimbursement, it's never going to happen, because that's just unfortunately the business of healthcare.
So here's what I want to understand. All that makes sense. We all know that that's out there. We all know the issues that we're faced with. There's like right here, there's four people. There's multiple millions of us out there. You're doing a fabulous job on TikTok. Someone's doing this. We're doing research, whatever. How do we coordinate it so that this message is, we've got TikTok. We've got these experts that are us, that are the people who are living with it, move beyond the medical, not getting what we need out of our medical, the medical part of the diagnosis. How can we bring this all together so it is on a checklist? Did you have a DAT scan? Did you know? And how do we get that out? How do we do it?
So this is just my opinion, but this is, again, what I did as a career. So we always have, so I'm going to use diabetes for an example. Okay. When you get diagnosed with diabetes, there is a criteria, and it's released every couple of years by the American Association for Diabetes. Okay. And it's like, you need to have a blood glucose of this level. You should try, make sure they're on a statin. You should try metformin versus this, and they should be on it for this. Like, and these are called clinical guidelines, right? And I use diabetes because diabetes is really, they're so good at it. They keep them very current. They're very consistent about pushing them out, and the doctors rely on them, right? Because not everybody is an expert, on every disease, right? So while the doctor always has clinical judgment and the ability to step outside that guidance, it creates a framework, what we call a framework, right? That everybody's kind of playing with the same rule book. And it's based on best practice is what we call it, best practice. And all that means is there's studies done somewhere that support this. Okay, so years ago, there were studies like large longitudinal studies of diabetics that said, if you are on a statin, a cholesterol reducing medication, you'll have a better outcome with your diabetes, right? So then the government said, okay, as part of the quality measures for diabetes, everybody that gets diagnosed with diabetes is going to get a statin, right? And everybody started doing it unless you have some contraindication. So when I first got diagnosed, I was like, okay, I'm going to go find the guidelines for Parkinson's and I'm going to see if like the care that I got is in line with the guidelines, right? Guess what?
Wasn't.
There's no guidelines. Right. I found that they call it NICE. In the UK, they have something called NICE, which is their NHS developed guidelines. I found them in Canada. I found them in Brazil. I found them in Japan, but I never found our guidelines. And so I don't know if I called or emailed. I think I called. I don't remember, but I do have Parkinson's. So but I reached out to somebody at the American Academy of Neurology because that is the beauty of the internet now. You can literally like email the president. he doesn't check it, I'm sure, but you know. So I was like, excuse me, I can't find your clinical guidelines on Parkinson's. And they're like, okay, yeah, that's because we don't have any, but this is what we do have. And they push me, they have like a guidance letter about our medication, which just basically says what I talked about before is that if you have young onset, just start the L-DOPA, like just start the meds. And I was like, okay, awesome. And then they're like, but we have like a committee that meets that you can ask for additional guidelines to be introduced and proposed. And we'll think about it. And I was like, okay, that'd be nice. Like, that'd be a nice first step, you know, to have. But once again, it's going to take the research, right? And the problem is the lack of research too. Like, we don't have those long longitudinal studies like diabetes have. We have my doctor at Mayo is actually a researcher. He doesn't see that many patients anymore. And he told me right off, he's like, you look at those studies, like 50 people in it. And it's like 20 years old. And they're all, I mean, I'm sorry, but they're all men over the age of 60. I mean, that's also what I know a lot of people internationally are working on is like, we need those studies. We need that data to develop those best practices to tie to guidance. It's like how that works. But on the flip side is what we call, and that's quantitative data. On the flip side is what we call qualitative data. So if I could ask 10,000 people in a survey, what's your experience with Rasagiline? That's value-added data too, right? It has power too. And the system is starting to recognize that. Medicare and Medicaid is kind of who calls the shots on a lot of this stuff in this country. And they are asking for that now. They're recognizing that. And that's what I mean when I say our stories are so powerful. Because if all the orgs could come together to collect that kind of data and share that information, and they're doing it. And they did it with that study that came out about 2 months ago about that Michael J. Fox and Parkinson's Foundation did together, where they looked at something crazy like 100,000 Parkinson's patients and they pulled from that coding data I mentioned. And they said like only 30%, less than 30% are seeing an MDS ever, or less than 50% are ever seeing a psychiatrist, even though, you know, 80% have depression. So that study excited me because I was like, that's the numbers that we're used to dealing with. And that's the way we get that data. But what are we going to do about it, right? How are we going to get that message out there to make sure that it gets ordered every time, that everybody gets that referral, that everybody gets that same information? And that's the real challenge.
Okay, so we don't have that level of the data at this time, but we have all of our stories that kind of converge into the same story, because we've all had, many have had the same issues. How do we get that out there, like you said, through this funnel of all these different amazing organizations, and everyone's putting out information? When I got out, I would have liked to know, I need a psychiatrist. I need a good neurologist. I may need a muscle movement specialist. I need, maybe for Medicare, you know, whatever, maybe for retirement. There's that. Where is that? Are we the voice now of that?
Ellen, would you have gone if you had that option?
Gone where?
See a psychiatrist.
I mean, I did. Somehow I just, someone told me you need to go to a psychiatrist, but it's like, okay, you're going to a psychiatrist because of this, and then you're going to your muscle movement specialist because of this. It's all the continuum of care. But I didn't know any of that. I didn't know one thing to do.
My MDS told me upon diagnosis that at Mayo, which is what I consider my final diagnosis, the one in February this year, he said, anxiety and depression are going to be what gets you more than anything else. And I don't want to pick on people or judge people, but like, that's why Mayo's Mayo, because they have real interdisciplinary teams. They had the ability to have an MDS see me same day, just text him and dude pops up. Come on, who is doing that? Mayo, Cleveland Clinic, probably, maybe John Hopkins. There's just centers of excellence, stuff like that. But majority of people don't have access to that. And I'm extremely privileged and I recognize that. So how do we get that information out? I think first of all, I mean, actually this is kind of funny. Like yesterday I just started a spreadsheet of like all of the stuff that people have told me that I wish I would have known. Like we were talking yesterday, Heather's in a support group that I'm in. That's like a bunch of, I think Chris Sudfin's, no, Eric from Gray Strong started.
And Eric.
And we were talking about swallowing stuff. And Parky Mike, which is a friend of mine who started Parky Chat as well, he had said that somebody told him on TikTok that if when you swallow, you tuck your chin in, it helps. And I had gone to an educational event PMD Alliance had like 3 days before, and their speech therapist said the same thing, like when you take a pill, don't take it like drink like this, you know, like tuck your chin. And he was like, I did it and I swallowed right for the first time in 3 years. And he's like, he has had like esophageal stretching and like all of these, he's seen like two speech therapists. Like this anecdotal evidence is important. I don't think the healthcare system itself is ever going to be the source of that information, because we're science-based, right? So we have to have that data to support us. Unless, again, we were to vet it through tens of thousands of people. And that's part of why I became an ambassador with the Parkinson's Foundation, that we have to be our own ambassadors, and we have to do a better job at destigmatizing this stuff, especially like the sex stuff and the mental health stuff. I don't know why. For me, again, it's just part of medical care. If you know you have this pathophysiology that is going to make you anxious and depressed and apathetic, why is there stigma around that? If you know you're taking this medication that's either going to make you not want to have sex or not able to have sex or go cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs with too much sex and porn and everything else, like, why wouldn't you just tell us that? So I told Parkinson's Foundation, I'm going to take the information that they give me, and then I'm going to put my own two cents in about stuff. And all I can control is what's in driving distance of my house. But in driving distance of my house, I want everybody to have this information. And if that means they go to my Instagram DMs or my TikTok DMs or whatever it is, I'll be that girl. And that's why I keep trying to tell everybody, like, they think like being an ambassador is like somebody called me and is like, congratulations, Miss Texas. You have been chosen because you're so special. That's not how it works. Like, you just call them and you're like, I want to do stuff. And they're like, cool, we're not going to pay you. Awesome.
So Esther, I got a question. You mentioned two people that threw a question into my mind, Eric and Chris. Now they are working on some interesting things within the ER setting of the hospital experience. And within the community of people that I've spoken with and my own experience, if Heather was still on the call, she had to go out because she's got some training that she had to do with a coach of hers. But I know that she would hit on this question really hard too. What is it that we can do to help with the people who have Parkinson's, who then have an ER experience, to be able to engage properly the ER staff so that we're not taken as, say, a psych patient or just basically, so we're believed? What is it that we can do beyond the kits that are available currently, because they're not helping? I understand that they were set up with this exact intention, but there's got to be something else too.
Yeah. So first of all, I do want to speak to the AmeriCare kits, because I had, a board subcommittee this week, and they're updating some things and re-releasing them. So that's awesome. And Parkinson's Foundation also, like I said, based, even if you just listen, and I strongly suggest and I'm not a shill. I'm an equal opportunity listener and consumer of information. And I
thank you for coming on here and sharing, because a lot of times people just need to be directed to how to absorb the information better. Yeah. And, you know, I think that that's one cool thing when you are an ambassador and you come on these shows, that I think it's important that you speak to these things from a position of authority. So thank you. No need to apologize whatsoever, Esther.
But what that doctor was talking about, as far as pilot testing, some checklists and different things, that's the future. I mean, that's the path. Okay. And I had no knowledge about that until I listened to it. And I was like, hallelujah. But when it comes to ERs, and I posted about this, but EDs are a different animal than hospitals. Okay. So I've mentioned in my post, most emergency physicians do not work for the hospital. Sometimes the entire department is kind of outsourced in a way. And I'm not making any judgment. Actually, I have very close friends that are amazing emergency department physicians and nurses. And that is a rough job. That is for real the knockdown, drag out crazy town. And I've worked with them for decades. You have to keep in mind that healthcare in the ED, for one thing, is very high risk for employees and very violent. Okay. I don't know a single person that's worked in an ER that hasn't been hit, spat on, thrown on the ground, had a gun pulled on them, had a knife pulled on them. Healthcare workers get murdered in EDs. I mean, that's unfortunately a fact. Okay. So the people that work there are special. But there's a different thing going on now post-COVID. I'll just put it that way. Okay. So we have staffing shortages across the systems, and they're so much worse. And so everybody that could and, you know, had that inclination of F this stuff, left. As soon as we got work from home options and stuff, we were like, deuces. And so the older, you know, more experienced, and I'm not talking just in ED, in all the departments, jump ship. And so that compounded a lot of the existing problems that we had. So I, as a risk manager, always handled complaints. So let's say you're Heather and you go into the ED and they stick you in a hallway and you're just screaming in pain and you just have a experience. And then when you're done, you file a complaint. Like, that would land on my desk. And I wouldn't even have to read it to know who it was about, right? We know who the good ones are. We know who the bad ones are. Back in the day, we'd write you up. We'd sit you down. We'd counsel you. We'd mentor you. You know, we'd start the whole process. But now, we don't have anybody to replace you. So if we lose another one, we got to shut down. And if you shut down needy, then it shuts down the whole hospital the way that the licensing is. So our hands are tied in a lot of situations too. It doesn't excuse any of it, but that's part of it. Secondly, emergency departments and hospitals in general are acute care facilities. So we're there to keep you alive, right? So if you come in with your ADHD and your depression and your Parkinson's and your whatever that's not going to kill you within the next 48 hours, that's low priority, all right? That's just how they're trained, which is so important, is how they're trained, right? How we're educated to do our job. And that's a big part of it is education. And again, goes back to, do you really understand what Parkinson's is? I mean, really, because I did a talk to 24 providers and there were audible gasps to half of the symptoms that I talked about, because the symptoms that they're taught are the ones to look for are not even the symptoms most of us care about, right? Do they understand that if we don't take that medication, what that means to us? Not at all. All they know is it's not going to kill us. So that sounds like your neurologist problem, right? So for me, that whole issue with pain is probably the best approach, because there are, and I'm speaking, you know, specifically to Heather, but I hear that a lot anyway, just in general, because there are specific regulations and guidance and requirements around managing pain. It's considered a patient right, right? But people don't know their rights, and they don't know what that means, and they don't know what to do if they're not met. Because if people don't say, like, if somebody comes in and says, this bad thing happened, it's like, that sucks. We're going to do a little razzle dazzle. But if we hear it, what I always do is, and did in healthcare, was like trends, right? So if one person is like an outlier, right? That's just a Karen. Two people is like, well, it's not good. Three people is like, we got to have a meeting, y'all. But I need like five before I'm even going to pull in my boss. And people are not vocal about their care. People are not educated about their rights. You get that thing that you sign, right? Or they hand you that piece of paper and they're like, these are your rights, sign it. Or now you don't even get the paper. You just sign the screen, right? And you're like, these are your rights.
And you're so like, I've got a follow-up question on the pain comment, because it seems that there's a little bit of a counteraction going on within the doctors, because if I go into the ER and my complaint then basically is of pain, because there's certain criteria that have to be met. Right now we're in the midst of an opiate crisis. So a lot of people are in the ER setting are being accused of pain med seeking, when that's not actually what's going on. We have falls and things like that in the Parkinson's community, and injuries do actually happen, but the frequency of how they happen and the frequency of appearances of people with Parkinson's into the ED, as you call it, the emergency department, seem to be of the same frequency of people who are drug seeking. So we fall into a similar classification there. So how then would you recommend that people with Parkinson's communicate with the emergency department staff about their pain so that we can avoid being in that same pool?
Okay, I'm going to answer that question, but I'm going to back up a little bit. But if I forget, bring me back to it. So number one, and I'm going to say this with a very strongly stated caveat, if you feel like you need emergency care, call 911, go to emergency room. I'm going to speak for me. I will do anything to stay out of an ED. Okay. I tell my kids all the time, if you're not bleeding, if you can walk, if you can breathe, if you can talk, we ain't going to the ED. We're going to urgent care. Okay. Because that's the way the system is set up when it comes to what we call triage, like levels of care. Okay. So if I have a bleeding wound, then I might think about it. I'll probably still go to urgent care, to be honest with you, because they still now with the freestanding EDs still have imaging and lab and everything else that's going to cost me less. But number one is Parkinson's patients. I think we need to be better at avoiding the ED in the first place, because it's very uncommon to just wake up and be like, I'm in excruciating pain, right? Yes, if you had a fall or something like that. But most of these things, in my opinion, are a failure on the outpatient side, right? So you had this pain, but your follow-up with your neurologist is not till July. So you're just sucking it up, trying to white-knuckle it till you get to that next follow-up. Or you have this pain, maybe it's not even related to Parkinson's. That happened to me. Like I had gallstones, but I was 100% convinced it was Parkinson's related. So, but did I call my PCP? No, I called my neurologist, and he was like, call your PCP. And then people feel like bounced around, right? Cause then you're like, well, it's going to take me 3 months to get into my PCP. And then that time goes by until it's unbearable, and then you go to the ED, right? Instead of asking, like, why couldn't I get a same-day appointment with the PCP? Like, why couldn't I have at least got the ball rolling? Because when you go to the ED, they're just going to do the imaging and stuff anyway, right? And a lot of people use the ED for that. So, like, you're going to wait 3 months for your scan, but go to the ED, I'm going to get it right away, right? Like, it's that preventative part that's like, are you keeping all your follow-up appointments? I know I'm horrible about it, you know? Like, that day comes and I'm like, oh, my kid's got this. I can't do it today. I'll do it next week. And then I wait another 2 weeks, and then 2 weeks becomes six. And, or the pain goes away. Like, with Parkinson's, like, right now I'm having, like, really bad pain right here. But it's not going to be there tomorrow. But it might be there Sunday. You know, that piece is so important to keep us out of it. But back to your question with when you get there and drug seeking, because you're right. We do think you're drug seeking, because 15 other people that day were drug seeking.
Yep.
And that goes to back to education about Parkinson's itself. And I said this on a tweet, I don't know, X-eat, I don't know what we call it now, about a study that they did about this. So there's tons of data about this. This is one of those few areas that there's a ton of data. Like, I can find recommendations from 15 years ago on this. Like, it's not a new thing. There's tons of data out there on this. But are you going to take the time to educate that staff on what this disease looks like? Because if I go in and I pull an ED nurse or doc and I ask them to talk about presenting symptoms for Parkinson's, what are they going to say? Tremor, rigidity, boop, 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 boop. They are not going to say pain. All right. I have literally had doctors tell me, and if you just go on WebMD and type in Parkinson's, there's a thing, it pops up. It's like, if you compare MS to Parkinson's, that Parkinson's doesn't usually have as associated with pain. Like, it says that Parkinson's is not usually associated with pain.
Absolutely. It's crazy.
Yeah. So how we educate people in the hospital are through what we call learning management systems. They're these big
continuing education, right?
They're these big electronic systems that we push out, you know, information to the staff on. And I say that because I just purchased one. That was one of the last things I did where I came from, was I vetted all of the vendors and I purchased one.
Did it have a Parkinson's continuing education program within it?
No, there's nothing there about Parkinson's. And all of
you professionals out there listening, there's your opportunity.
Because I could so easily create one in conjunction with any organization, preferably the one I'm with, of course, push it out for, let's say, Parkinson's Awareness Month. And then all the large hospital corporations be like, look, we're doing something about Parkinson's. We care. Yeah. Here's our tulip. But until that step gets taken, they're not going to associate it with that, because that's not what the thinking is. And they just don't see it enough to make that determination.
Well, and then there's the question of liability too. And they always have to go back on their training, or else, you know, there's a liability question there. If anything goes wrong and they were stepping outside of any of the continuing education that you have provided, they're then liable themselves versus the hospital, correct?
Yeah. And it also becomes really dicey with EDs in particular, because of that fact that they aren't usually employed by the hospital. They aren't usually also included in our training programs, not in the same way as the regular staff. So, yeah, but I also know how to fix that too.
I had one comment that I wanted to talk to you about, and we can talk about this offline, because I want to make a solution to what we're talking about, which I know there's no solution, but from what we hear is, we're not going to get it necessarily from the medical community until it's completely educated, whatever all of these roadblocks that we have. But we have people like you, and we have people like us doing a podcast, and we've got bloggers, and we're all talking out there. But how could we figure out a way to be talking topics that, you know, diagnosis topics, questions to ask following your diagnosis, whatever? How can we join as communicators to push this out from the non-medical side of this, so people know what questions to ask their doctors? People, oh, really? There's no anxiety, and, you know, things that we're told, these stigmas, how can we reach our audiences in a more cohesive way?
So I'm going to go back to the first part of that question, which is, first of all, there are solutions to this. I firmly believe that, because it just has to be that way. And I've seen big problems get solved in healthcare over the years. You know, my father was a physician. I grew up, this is the family business. And there's been improvement over the years in a lot of areas through systematic change. Okay. But then I also want to mention what you guys were talking about with Eric and yes. Chris, because his foundation is doing the grassroots work on topics like this. He has a checklist already of what we should have when we get diagnosed. So then there's no need for us to reinvent the wheel, right? Like, this information is out there. So then that comes to the latter part of your question, which is, how do we get it to the patients upon diagnosis? So that's going back to the information provided at the time. And some doctors are good at it and some aren't. But then like Michael was saying, like, would you have done that, right? And so if somebody would have given me this card that day, I wouldn't have called. I wasn't even trying to think about that. I was trying to go home and get ready for Thanksgiving. and a lot of people are like that, especially with young onset. I hear that all the time. Like, I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to think about it. Like, I just want to live my life, and we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. And I'm going to exercise and eat healthy and be here for my kids. And this is what it is, right? So then it becomes, this is something that Eric and I were actually talking about on that support group, was his philosophy is, we are the CEOs of our own healthcare, right? Which I love. But I disagree with him to a point. It's not a disagreement. It's like two sides of a coin, right? So there's empowering ourselves to ask for things, to ask for resources. And then the systems being there to make sure that everybody gets them, right? Because if I'm not me, if I'm a 70-year-old Hispanic man that English is my second language, and I don't have consistent cell phone service or internet service, you know, like, how am I going to have access that information, right? But if I'm a friend, like, I have a friend who just got diagnosed, who's a 25-year-old gay guy in New York, whose like whole life is on his phone, where is he going to get that information? So it has to be accessible to everyone, and it has to be consistent. For me, I have always said that I feel like there needs to be a really strong national media campaign, if only on the, you know, let's say YouTube or whatever, where everybody comes under one umbrella and says, this is what this looks like. This is not what you think it is. I was at a thing and I was talking to the Abbott rep for DBS, and she was like, you're too young for this disease. I'm like, why are you saying that? like, I appreciate it. Like, I know that, you know, people are super well-intentioned and stuff, but it's like, obviously not. And I know people way younger than me, like way younger than
How
me.
About the, but you look so good.
I know, but you well, look fine. You. I'm like, awesome.
I feel like crap.
I feel like inside. Or my favorite, I lost 20 pounds when I got diagnosed because the risagiline gave me the runs like nobody's business. And everybody was like, and then when I took the levodopa, I was just nauseous all the time. And then, you know, we can't eat half an hour before and 30 minutes after and every other Tuesday. So I just stopped eating and everybody was like, you look fabulous. Like, that's great. What's your secret? Well, so I cut out food.
I had someone do that to me. She kept saying, God, you look so good and you're so thin. And finally, like after about 2 months of this, my neighbor, I was like, I have Parkinson's. It's not a good thing that I lost all this weight.
And look, my arm is like so buff now, but that's because it doesn't stop moving.
There's no fat on there.
This one, not so much.
What you're saying, everything here makes sense. And we have, I think, from a social media perspective, and I consider the social media as well as the everything we do, we need to come up with a plan that could get these messages out through the organization. We have all the organizations doing it, but people just aren't finding it.
You know, somebody made an interesting comment to me when that Michael J. Fox Still documentary came out, which I know we all love. And like, I love him so much. Like, I'm Gen X. Like, that's my dude. But that friend of mine who got diagnosed at 25, he was like, I think people forget that he got diagnosed at what, like 29 or something? Like, he was extremely young when he got diagnosed, right? But people don't associate young him with Parkinson's. They associate older him with Parkinson's. Who is really the face of, for this generation, younger Parkinson's, which again, as much as people seem to like not want to accept this, I'm here to tell you it is getting younger and younger and younger. I don't know if that's a function of better diagnosis, kind of like autism or what, but I have almost 4,000 followers on TikTok now, and not a week goes by that somebody under 30 doesn't DM me. So that's, if we don't recognize it and they don't recognize it, how is anybody else going to recognize it?
I think you hit it on the head with that, the increase in connectivism. You know, we're all connected to each other. And with you, how you described you noticing your symptoms, and then your connectivism within your industry led your diagnosis probably earlier than what most people would have figured it out.
Yeah, I was going to say, you were 26, Nathan.
I was 26 when I was diagnosed, 24 when my symptoms started, yeah. Going on 38 now, the 18th is my birthday.
Happy birthday.
You're young looking 38.
What's that?
You're young looking 38.
Ah, thanks, man.
We're 20 years older.
I work out a lot.
Well, speaking of that, I'll tell you something. In my boxing group, when I got diagnosed in 18, it was me and another person, and we were the youngers. Now we have a huge group of young onsets boxing, doing yoga, doing everything that we do. And it's just been since 18 that I've noticed that.
I think that it kind of draws the whole conversation back to the central point that I took from it. Esther, maybe you didn't mean to say this, and I'll put words in your mouth, but the system is set up well with a lot of people who have put a lot of time and heart and effort into the system, but it's not there to spoon feed you people. It's up to you to get the education and go out and figure your way. Like what Esther was describing, she had a very good charted path because, you know, she was in the industry, but you don't. And it's up to you, people with Parkinson's, to get out there and figure out what is it that I need to do as my next step? What makes sense? What is going on? You've got to ask yourself these questions, take notes and take them into the hospital setting or the doctor setting and ask questions.